This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. This is David Rutledge. Thanks for joining us this week. Today, we're going to be talking about misogyny and sexism in our social arrangements, in our politics, and in philosophy. And who better to be talking about all of this than one of Australia's foremost feminist and moral philosophers? Producer Rashna Farooq has the story.
There's a statistic which is one woman a week dies at the hands of violence.
It is so important for our nation, the whole world in fact, to listen to survivors' stories. Whilst they are disturbing to hear, the reality of what goes on behind closed doors is more so.
It made me wonder, what kind of environment is this where men think they can just have a crack at it?
This is not new. This has been happening since the dawn of time, and I can guarantee you that every friendship group, women in various professions, every family WhatsApp group, they have got a thread about men that are creepers, men that are horny, men that are abusive, men that you need to stay away from.
As a man's bitch, I was offended by those things. Misogyny.
What is misogyny? Does it affect you? Me? Your friends, family, loved ones? Are we a part of the problem? And why does misogyny continue to exist in a modern-day egalitarian country like the US, like Australia? These are big, often uncomfortable questions. But against the backdrop of sexual assault allegations in Parliament House, a rise in domestic violence, and calls for better consent education in schools, the questions need to be asked, and philosophers might have some of the answers. We're joined by Kate Mann, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Cornell University and author of Down Girl and Entitled.
I actually went to an all-boys school in the outer suburbs of Melbourne the year the school integrated or went co-ed. So I was one of three girls at an all-boys school for my final 2 years of high school. So I think that was really the formative experience that got me interested in misogyny, if not by name. I didn't have the word for it then. It wasn't really one of my words until much, much later on in my life. But I did encounter what I now think of as misogyny at that school, unsurprisingly, and it had an impact.
Yeah, you once said in an interview, I am political before I'm philosophical, and I've always been. So I was wondering, why did you become a philosopher?
Yeah, it's a good question. I really did fall in love with the discipline from my very first philosophy class, which I took at Melbourne University with Christopher Cordner. And it, I think maybe one of the things that most attracted me to the discipline was that it was a place where disagreement was not only welcome, but it was in a way compulsory. Philosophy, as you obviously know, thrives on disagreement, and disagreement is seen as healthy and something that is actually a sign of intellectual advance rather than something to be minimized or worried about. And so I think it was in some ways a very liberating practice and discipline for me to enter into, because as a woman who sometimes felt uncomfortable disagreeing with people in ordinary social circumstances, it was like this hallowed zone where suddenly disagreement was welcome and the aim of the exercise.
Yeah, that's what I find very attractive about philosophy as well. You've written a lot about misogyny. How can we better understand misogyny? What is it really about?
Yeah, so I think of misogyny as, metaphorically speaking, the law enforcement branch of patriarchy. So I think of it as a system that functions to police and enforce patriarchal norms and expectations by visiting women with hostility and hatred, especially when they don't conform to our idea of what a good woman is. And so I think of that as something which is a very active and dynamic system that contrasts with sexism, which I think of as a system of beliefs and cultural narratives, as an overall ideology that functions to rationalize and naturalize patriarchal social relations. So in a nutshell, sexism is kind of the bad science of patriarchy, and misogyny is its police force.
But do you have to hate women to participate in the system of misogyny?
No, and that's a really important point. On this way of thinking about things, misogyny is about what women face and not what people, mostly individual men, feel. And it might not be that people who engage in misogynistic acts or practices feel this visceral hatred towards women, either very generally or even universally. It might be much more that they are enforcing social norms of a gendered kind and acting, say, resentfully if a woman doesn't toe the line and doesn't conform to their sense of what a woman should do or be. So it needn't be something that involves hatred. It needn't be something that involves individuals whatsoever. It could be that many instances of misogyny are perpetuated by social practices and systems as a whole rather than individual hate-filled people.
And where does entitlement fit into all of this?
Yeah, that's really important. So when I began to work on this topic of misogyny, and this definition was something I was defending, it immediately left this question open. So if misogyny polices and enforces patriarchal norms and expectations, then what are the patriarchal norms and expectations, especially in superficially egalitarian contexts like the US and Australia, my home country, as I hope my accent still makes relatively clear, although I know it's a funny hybrid at this point. In those contexts, my sense is that the norms and expectations are primarily a matter of saying that men, especially privileged men, are entitled to certain goods from women, a particularly similarly or less privileged women. And those goods can be things like sex, perhaps most obviously, but still more insidiously, things like love and care and compassion, as well as power and deference and claims to knowledge. So the sense that men are entitled to those goods and that women should supply them, and women, in contrast, are less entitled to those goods, even when I would think those entitlements are genuine or actual. That's the kind of differential systems of gendered norms and expectations that I think misogyny enforces. So it lashes out at women who are perceived as flouting what men are owed or what they deserve.
But would it be fair to say that not all men are entitled, and in fact, some women are also entitled?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to see that entitlement is more than an attitude. It's something which is a prevailing system of who is generally socially deemed entitled to certain goods and who is deemed obligated to supply those goods. And I would say that in general, that system of entitlements and obligations, often pseudo-obligations, does reflect various kinds of social privilege, including gender. But certainly that's not to say that all men feel entitled to more than they're due, or to deny that some women, especially, I should say, white women, may feel entitled to more than they deserve. Those possibilities are perfectly compatible with a general social trend of positing certain kinds of uneven differential entitlements due to gender.
Yeah, you talk about these genuine entitlements. What do you mean by that?
So I'm thinking of things like, for one concrete example, healthcare. So one thing I've been thinking a lot about recently are, and here it's important as ever to be intersectional in our thinking and think about the ways that gender and race intersect. And especially in the US context, Black women are denied healthcare routinely and treated abysmally within the healthcare system, such that, for example, Black women here are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during or immediately after childbirth as compared with white female counterparts. And I take it to be intuitively very plausible to say that, in fact, to me, undeniable that Black women are owed more by society, that they're genuinely entitled to good healthcare. And thus the problem becomes one of looking at what attitudes and, more importantly, structures and policies would need to change in order to give Black women what they're entitled to within a society that has systematically denied them those genuine entitlements to healthcare.
Right. So certain groups are getting more than the entitlements that they are entitled to, whereas other people are not getting those genuine entitlements met.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's important to see that on this way of looking at things, coming at this as a moral philosopher, I'm not holding that entitlement is a dirty word. I think that many entitlements are genuine and correspond roughly to what people have a right to, what they deserve, what they're owed, and what often others have an obligation to provide them with. And the difficulty is just getting clear on who is genuinely entitled to what and when and from whom. And the substantive and in some ways empirical claim that I'm making in more recent work trying to defend looking at the relevant empirical evidence is that there's a tendency to hold that men, especially privileged men, are entitled to more than is in fact plausible to think that they're entitled to, and to withhold from women, especially more vulnerable women, what they genuinely have an entitlement to do or to be or to have.
You wrote, "Often it's not a sense of women's humanity that is lacking. Her humanity is precisely the problem." I find that so interesting because we kind of point to objectification of women as the problem. Can you explain a bit more about what you meant there?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad you picked up on that because one of the trends in thinking that I'm somewhat trying to push back against, even though I think it does capture something important, is the idea that all forms of oppression that are really serious and horrible and inhumane must involve dehumanization. So I think that's actually a theory that is belied by many of the ways that women are mistreated when it comes to misogynistic behavior. So for example, women are often punished for having their own sexuality and their own making their own autonomous choices about who to partner with or who not to partner with. And in various ways, women's capacity for agency and autonomy and human action is actually the stuff that gets them a lot of hostility and hatred. And this is true in many areas, but the phenomenon of incels really embodies this possibility of hating women not as dehumanized, mindless objects, but precisely because they're seen as human, all too human, as people who are making choices that make these entitled men called incels or so-called involuntary celibates feel like these women are not giving them the kinds of human goods which some men feel owed by women by way of sexual admiration in particular.
Is it also that women then have the power to shame and humiliate and coerce and manipulate as well?
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things that people dread from other human beings is feeling belittled by them or feeling like other human beings look down upon us. There's, you know, that famous classic line from Margaret Atwood that men fear women laughing at them and women fear men killing them for laughing at them. And the idea that a woman would laugh at you and humiliate you as a man and that that is a kind of unforgivable sin, that is, again, human, all too human misstep that gets punished in, again, a distinctively human way. So I think the idea that women are dehumanized rather than treated sometimes as bad and deviant human beings who have not done right according to men's sense of entitlement. I'm trying to push back against that dehumanization paradigm there.
And would you say this kind of thinking is applicable to other groups as well, say like Black men going about their lives both here and in the US where you're based?
Yeah, I do tend to think that. And I should say I want to be careful here, and I think it's appropriate for me as a white, albeit Jewish woman, to have a fairly high degree of epistemic humility here about the extent to which these observations might carry over to certain racial groups. But I do think that it's not altogether plausible to think that there is at least always dehumanization going on. I think sometimes it's precisely when human beings who were previously historically seen as inferior are showing their human excellences and their capacity to excel and be, for example, the president of the United States, that you get horrific backlash. And people who, as white people, are deeply embedded in the structures of white supremacy and deeply committed to white supremacist ends, you have them lashing out in a racist manner precisely because of the unwelcome realization that people who they once regarded as racially inferior, it's just obvious that that hope and investment in other people's inferiority is false. And that the idea that equality is not always welcome to hitherto privileged groups is, it's kind of a bitter pill to swallow, but I think it's a true one.
On RN, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone. This week, producer Rashna Farooq is speaking with Kate Mann, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Cornell University in New York, and the author of Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, and Entitled, How Male Privilege Hurts Women.
Many women, as we've seen over the last few months in Australian politics, are also complicit in misogyny, as you define it. Why is that?
I think one way to look at it is, while sexism divides men and women into different groups and says they have radically different capacities in a way that seems to me false to our best empirical evidence, misogyny can be seen as dividing good women from bad women. Good, you know, in quotes, by the lights of patriarchal values and expectations. And I think because there's this division of good women versus bad women, it's really tempting as someone who's subject to these mechanisms, namely as a woman, to try to identify as a good woman, partly by pointing out bad women and policing them and punishing them accordingly. So I think patriarchy in general, and misogyny in particular, sets up these unfortunate incentives for women, especially, again, racially privileged white women, to really engage in misogynistic policing and bullying of other women, as well as propping up the powerful and privileged men who commit misogynistic acts.
I mean, there's this term in your work, himpathy, which describes our tendency to sympathise with male perpetrators as opposed to female victims. Is your argument here that we should extend more sympathy to women, or are you saying we should extend less sympathy to men?
Both, I think. I think there is this troubling tendency, just as you put it, to really empathise with, side with, and exonerate privileged men who commit horrific acts of misogyny, and to side with them and sympathize with them over their female victims. And of course, one possibility is, look, we should just sympathize with everyone and, you know, try to be empathetic across the board. It's not altogether clear to me that that's realistic in the first instance, because, to put it simply and somewhat crudely, empathy is partly a matter of taking a certain perspective as well as a certain kind of fellow feeling that accompanies that perspective taking. And you can only occupy so many perspectives at once if they're diametrically opposed. So what I would like to happen when it comes to, say, credible reports of sexual assault, I would like us to be not only inclined as a matter of a reasonable default to believe credible victims of sexual assault who come forward with these credible allegations, but to be on their side primarily and to look at the matter through their eyes, so to speak, and empathize with them and feel for them primarily, rather than the privileged men who may have committed these acts and who stand to suffer a loss of reputation.
You touched on this a little bit earlier. Australia and the US are egalitarian societies. So why does this stuff continue to happen here?
Yeah, I think part of it is that progress and backlash are not just compatible, but inextricably linked. You know, it's partly precisely because we have seen tremendous social progress and feminist and egalitarian progress in these societies that some people are resentful of that and resent the fact that there is a new social order that doesn't respect the kind of patriarchal hierarchies of yore. So I think that unfortunately, we can predict that when it comes to the sorts of things that ought to happen, namely increasing racial, gender, and class equality, that unfortunately, when those things do happen, it also tends to provoke ugly, toxic, and sometimes very dangerous backlash.
I want to turn to philosophy as a discipline. It's very male-dominated, and many prominent male thinkers have contributed to and also upheld systems of patriarchy. Is there a reckoning, a sort of Me Too moment that's bound to happen in philosophy? Should it happen in philosophy?
Yeah, absolutely. It should, and I think to some extent is. I mean, part of that reckoning has been that our discipline, unfortunately, has its fair, or I guess it should be unfair, share of sexual harassers and sexual predators who are beginning to be exposed, I think, in ways that are often confronting and which desperately need to happen. And that's something which is, you know, an ongoing process of reckoning, but needs to continue. And of course, the other thing, or one among many other things that needs to happen here, is a process of intellectual diversification, where we stop treating white men as the center of every debate and discourse that is worth having or engaging in. And I think that's happening slowly too. It's obviously, again, a process, but I'm optimistic that the discipline is changing in healthy ways.
Yeah. Are you kind of saying we need to broaden the scope of philosophical inquiry?
It doesn't necessarily follow from diversifying our discipline that that would happen, but I think it will very naturally happen, and I think it's independently a good thing for us to have a broader conception of what counts as philosophy. So as well as thinking about diversifying, you know, syllabi in, say, traditional areas of epistemology, we also have reason to think carefully about, well, are there areas of social epistemology that diverse practitioners are contributing to, perhaps are in some ways or on some occasions more drawn to because there are problems that closely affect members of the relevant marginalized groups? And how can we make those conversations not marginal to the discipline, but ideally part of a new center that is more welcoming, more diverse, and frankly, more interesting?
There is, I think, a hierarchy within philosophy. It seems some more masculine forms of thinking are higher up or taken more seriously than the more feminine. What has your experience been like?
Yeah, I started when I began to get interested in philosophy and thought about it seriously as first a major and then a little later as something I might devote my life to, I was most interested in some ways, the ultimate masculine-coded area of philosophy, namely logic. And I'm pretty sure I was drawn to it partly for contingent reasons. I had fantastic logic professors at Melbourne Uni, Greg Restall and Graham Priest, who were fantastic. But I also think I was probably drawn to it for some of the wrong reasons. Namely, it did seem like this ultimate masculine-coded activity. And it was actually only in a more feminist setting when I went to graduate school at MIT and had the amazing, wonderful feminist philosopher Sally Haslinger as my advisor. It was only then I became more comfortable thinking, well, what am I really interested in? And that turned out to be ethics and feminist philosophy more than logic in the end. And it was having that, her by way of a feminist role model and people around me who similarly reflected those values. And I think that's what allowed me to branch out and not just choose what was coded as the hardest and sotto voce, the most masculine thing to do. Yeah, that was very liberating.
Kate Mann, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Kate Mann is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Cornell University in New York. Her books are Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, and Entitled, How Male Privilege Hurts Women. And Kate Mann was speaking there with producer Rashna Farooq. All the detail on the Philosopher's Zone website, where you can find streaming and download links of this and all of our past programs. Coming up next week on the program, the strange, shadowy world of mathematical objects. We all use numbers every day of our lives, but in what sense do they actually exist? You can't trip over a number. You can't hold it in your hand. You can't even see it. So why do we place such faith in numbers?
I think the way that contemporary philosophers are inclined to think about mathematical objects is that we believe in them because of the role that they play in science. So, for instance, take something like a black hole. Now, a black hole is unobservable because you can't bounce a signal off a black hole. Any signal that you send towards a black hole just gets trapped. So you can't use any of the standard methods that we have for investigating that object or observing it. Now, mathematical objects, one of the things that's sort of worrying about them is they're unobservable in the same way, right? Like if you can't look at it, if you can't see, touch, smell, taste, whatever, how do you know that it's really there? And so philosophers argue that we should believe in mathematical objects more or less for the same reason that we believe in black holes, because they play this crucial role in science, and we should believe in anything that plays a certain kind of role in science.
Philosophy of Mathematics, coming up next week right here in the Philosopher's Zone. I'm David Rutledge. Hope you can join me then. Bye for now.